Thank you very much for the invitation, John. I really appreciate all of you showing up today. This book was a lot of work, and I'll tell you a funny story about it. You know, we had a deadline, of course, to get it to the publisher, and there's just so much to write about what Eric Holder has been doing, most of it bad. And I think this may just be volume one of a multi-volume book, but we finally got the book to the publisher, and it was almost like every single day thereafter, something else would come up in the news that Eric Holder had done, and I kept saying, John, God, we've got to update the manuscript. But, you know, there's only so much you can do, and once you hit the deadline, you can't do that. Look, we call this book Obama's Enforcer for a very special reason. Yeah, it's a catchy title, but it's also because that, in fact, is what Eric Holder is. Every time the president has broken the law, bent the law, ignored the law, or changed the law, the person at his side telling him how to do it has been Eric Holder. He has not really acted as the attorney general and the way an attorney general should. The best thing I can describe it as is he's acted really like a mob lawyer whose job it is to make sure that his boss can do whatever he wants and get away with it, and not do what an attorney general is supposed to do, which is be the chief law enforcement officer of the United States. Look, we all realize a president chooses his attorney general, and yeah, the attorney general is supposed to put in place the priorities that the president has. But unlike other cabinet officers, the attorney general has a special duty as an attorney and as a lawyer to make sure that the law is upheld. And what that means is that when the president wants to do something that is against the law or is unconstitutional, the attorney general has an obligation to tell him that he can't do that. That is not something that Eric Holder will do. Now, why should you be concerned about this? Well, the reason is that the Justice Department is probably the most powerful domestic cabinet agency that we have. The Justice Department can break any individual, any business, bankrupt them, and put them in jail. And that is a dangerous power if you have someone who is willing to abuse it. And what you have to understand with Eric Holder is that he considers himself part of the president's political team first, and attorney general a very distant second. Now, what we cover in this book is everything from how Holder first came to justice to then going through the various parts of the Justice Department and describing some of the things they've done. You need to understand, Eric Holder is not new to Washington. In fact, a lot of people forget he was the number two guy at the Justice Department during the Clinton administration. And not only that, but he was the go-to guy for the Clinton White House. Why? Because they didn't trust Janet Reno, the Attorney General, to do the right political thing. They trusted Eric Holder to do what they considered to be the right political team. And politics drives him, and you can see that if you look back at the Clinton administration. I'll just mention two things. I'm sure all of you have heard about the Mark Rich pardon, right? You know, that was a pardon that Eric Holder recommended to the president. It was unprecedented because at the time, Mark Rich was an international fugitive. The pardons office at the Justice Department, who's supposed to review pardon applications, had recommended against it. The prosecutors didn't want it because I don't think we'd ever had an instance where a presidential pardon had been given not to somebody who's been convicted and is in prison, but to somebody who had fled, and like I said, was an international fugitive. But of course, Mark Rich had given a lot of money to the Clintons to build a presidential library after the president's term was over, and so he recommended doing it. Now, you've all heard about that, but that isn't the worst thing that Eric Holder did in that connection. The worst thing he did was he recommended that the president pardon 16 terrorists who had been convicted and were in federal prison, who had been involved in 130 bombings, armed robberies, 6 killings and hundreds of injuries in New York, Chicago, and elsewhere. These were members of the FALN, which was a Puerto Rican terrorist group. And these people were so unremorseful and so dangerous that the federal judge who sentenced them said that if the death penalty had been an option, he would have imposed it. These individuals threatened him, the judge, in open court when he was sentencing them. Not only that, but they hadn't applied for pardons. Now, you're sitting there wondering, why in the world would the number two guy of justice recommend pardons for 16 convicted terrorists who had not applied for pardons? And in fact, who the pardon attorney, again, had recommended against. The prosecutors didn't want pardons, the victims didn't want pardons. Well, because this was at the end of the administration, and Hillary Clinton was starting her run for the Senate in New York, and the political consultants were telling her and telling Eric Holder that this might help her with the Puerto Rican vote in New York. So that tells you, gives you an example of how political he was during the Clinton administration, willing to sacrifice national security in order to give pardons to people who hadn't even sought them and doing it for political reasons. Now, we go through many other areas that one of the things, bad things about this book is it may give you nightmares. Because I have to tell you, John and I, even we were surprised. We write about justice all the time. I've got a piece today in National Review about the fact that Eric Holder lost big on Friday. I don't know if you all have already heard about this, but you know, he launched a lawsuit against North Carolina over their voter ID law. See, God, I'm mentioning voter ID. And on Friday, a federal judge issued a 125-page opinion completely shredding DOJ's claims that this was a discriminatory law and refusing to issue an injunction against it. So we cover many different areas, everything from environmental to civil rights to national security. One of the environmental cases that you're going to read this chapter and you're just going to be shaking your head because you can't believe this happened, is the way the administration went after Gibson Guitar Company. You know, they are a storied American guitar maker, produced guitars for some of the most famous musicians in the world, until a couple of years ago when the Obama Justice Department and federal agents showed up at their offices and factories armed to the teeth as if they were raiding a mobster or a drug cartel. Why? Because, well, they had supposedly violated these environmental laws on the importation of wood from abroad, and the government came in with armed agents to seize hundreds of thousands of dollars of wood that was going to be used to do what? Make fingerboards for guitars. Now, Gibson Guitar had evidence from Madagascar and India where they had gotten this wood, from the governments there saying this wood was perfectly legal, there was no problem with importing it, but all of these environmental allies of the administration had been pushing the administration to do something about this. This caused huge problems for Gibson Guitar. In the end, the government agreed to enter into what they call a deferred prosecution agreement. You know, that's an agreement where the government says, well, if you pay us some money, we will prosecute you. Okay, what I can really tell you is a deferred prosecution agreement is an agreement when the government realizes it doesn't have a case and they want to get out of it without too much embarrassment. And how do we know they didn't have a case? Well, because part of the agreement was they agreed to give back all the wood they had seized. And if you would like to get some of that wood, there's actually an ad, you can see it on the Gibson Guitar page for the Government Series 2 Les Paul, which celebrates, quote, an infamous moment in Gibson history, and this Gibson guitar can be used to fight the powers that be. But the point of this case is that it shows how politics drives the prosecution decisions now being made at the Justice Department. And you can see it in many other areas, too. One of the things we talk about in the book is that in the last few years of this administration, the Justice Department has lost 20 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court in which the justices ruled against the government 9-0. Now, look, administrations lose cases. There have been 9-0 cases in the prior administrations, but not at the rate that this administration loses them. And that's a sign to you of how extreme the legal positions are that the Justice Department is taking when your own former Solicitor General is even ruling against you. And it ranges in everything from them going to court and arguing that the feds could attach a GPS unit to your car without getting a warrant, without even having a reasonable suspicion that you've engaged in any crimes, to a case they just lost where they were arguing that if you get detained or stopped by the police, they should be able to get every bit of information you have off of your cell phone. Which is basically like saying that if you get stopped and you have a key to your house in your pocket, the government should be able to go into your house and seize everything in your house without a search warrant. But it's just one case after another like that. We cover the national security area. You probably don't realize this, but this Attorney General has opened up more investigations of the leaks of classified information than any prior Attorney General and all of them put together combined. But there's a very interesting pattern to those investigations, which is that whenever they can find some lower level person to prosecute, they do so. But in every instance where the information that was leaked clearly came directly out of the White House, and in fact was clearly leaked to make the president look tough, look like he was hard on terrorists, particularly before the elections, guess what? Those folks don't get prosecuted. In fact, the leaks coming out of the White House were so bad, particularly the leaks after the killing of Osama bin Laden that identified SEAL Team 6 and put their families in Norfolk in danger. Robert Gates, the former Secretary of Defense, he was so angry about the leaks coming out of the White House that he sent a message to the National Security Advisor for the President asking for a meeting to discuss, quote, a proposed new strategic communications policy. He shows up at the White House, he goes in, and the National Security guy says, oh, this is really interesting. What is this new strategic communications policy you want to discuss? And Robert Gates leaned over to him and said, shut the blank up. But see, those leaks don't get investigated. And the folks in the White House who did this don't get prosecuted. How bad is it at the Justice Department today? One of the folks that we interviewed was hired during the Clinton administration, who has since left the department, told us that he thinks, in terms of the politicization of the department, that Eric Holder is the worst Attorney General since Mitchell under Nixon. And actually, he makes Mitchell look like an amateur. And another quote we got from a current employee of the department, which I just want to give you, I don't want to read you a long quote, but I just want to give you this, the essence of this. This person said that Eric Holder has racialized and radicalized the department to the point of corruption. They've embedded politically leftist extremists in the career ranks who have an agenda that does not comport with equal protection or the rule of law, who believe that the ends justify the means, and who behave unprofessionally and unethically. And if you want to hear about behaving unprofessionally and unethically, John is going to tell you about what they've been doing with the inspector generals in some news that just came out. I will end you with this. As I said, this is a very serious issue. Book is not a partisan attack. In fact, we talk about the fact how there have been terrific attorney generals in the Justice Department of both parties. But the way that Eric Holder sees everything is through a prism of race and politics. And you can see that in the decisions being made every day, the prosecution decisions, and the way they handle those. I was astonished at how many cases we found that have been thrown out by the courts in the last few years, cases that don't make the news that you haven't heard about, where the federal judges accused the prosecutors of prosecutorial abuse. Including, by the way, a case down in New Orleans, which I will mention because this is the extreme circumstance. Just tell you how bad it's gotten. The Civil Rights Division was prosecuting some police officers in New Orleans for some stuff that happened after Katrina. The judge tossed out the prosecution. Why? Because he discovered that lawyers in the Justice Department, including in the U.S. Attorney's Office in New Orleans, who were part of the prosecution of this case, and lawyers at the Civil Rights Division in Washington, were posting anonymous blogs on the website of the Times-Picayune newspaper attacking the defendants, attacking the defendants' lawyers. And this included the lawyer at the Justice Department who was what's called the taint lawyer. Now, for those of you who don't do criminal prosecutions, you may not realize this, but you know, when a police officer is interviewed by the criminal investigative division within the department because of some incident that has happened, they have to answer every question that's given to them. And because of that, the Supreme Court has said that when they're giving that kind of testimony to the internal investigators, that testimony cannot later be used against them. Because, you know, they basically are forced to waive their Fifth Amendment right. So that evidence can't be used against them. In this case, a lawyer was appointed as what's called the taint lawyer at the Justice Department, whose job it was to make sure that the other prosecutors did not use this tainted evidence in their prosecution. She was one of the people who had been charged with protecting the rights of the defendants who was posting these anonymous blogs attacking the defendants. She still works at the Justice Department. As far as I know, she hasn't been disciplined. And as has another lawyer there, who there was an IG report released last year about the mismanagement of the Civil Rights Division. And in the report, one of the lawyers there committed perjury by lying to the IG investigators about the fact that she was posting anonymous blogs, attacking other lawyers, and revealing confidential work product from inside the division. She's been neither disciplined nor terminated by the department. Why? Because her anonymous blogs were attacking conservatives. And she was actually treated as a hero by the political appointees for having done that. That's how bad it is at the department. So now John is gonna talk about some more specifics about the book, but thanks for having me.
Well, we want to get to your questions as quickly as possible, so I'll try to just do one small segment of what I think our current problem is. By the way, it's great to be before such a friendly and interested audience. Robert Caldwell and I, 2 days ago, were both at the American Bar Association. I got to speak on class action lawsuits and the use that attorneys general have been making of contingency fee outside counsel. I can assure you that the audience that I spoke at had 2 words from you, and they were not happy birthday. I'm just going to address one small part of, I think, what is effectively a stonewall of our justice system. We elected Barack Obama in 2008 with him promising the most open and transparent government in American history. Now, that is a promise that last year he said he had kept. He said, I run the most open and transparent government in American history. Well, someone who disagrees with him are the two-thirds of his own inspectors general in the various agencies and cabinet departments. You may not have read this in the mainstream media, but last week, 47 of the 73 inspectors general sent a letter to the chairman, chairwomen, and ranking members of the congressional committees saying, we believe there are serious obstacles being put in our path which prevent us from carrying out our job of rooting out waste, fraud, and abuse in federal agencies. And among the departments signing it were the Treasury Department, the Department of Homeland Security, the National Security Agency, Transportation, a whole range of agencies. I found this amusing because the ability of this administration to engage in cognitive dissonance, which is the ability to do two things at the same time in your mind and somehow reconcile them, is remarkable. Last week, the president hosted about 50 leaders from Africa at the White House in Democracy Forum. Part of that involved the president and Vice President Biden speaking to them about the importance of extending the rule of law and expanding it in Africa. Vice President Biden told them that one of their top priorities should be, quote, a need to have in every government agency within the U.S. call an inspector general, someone who's able to run through every department, and he listed all of them that were relevant, to be able to look at the books, to be able to look at everything that's transpired with independent eyes, and who cannot be fired. He said, widespread corruption is an affront to the dignity of people and a direct threat to each of your nation's stability. Complete and open transparency is the answer. Well, that's not what the inspectors general appointed by the Obama administration think. And if you think that these are conservative holdovers from the Bush administration, over 80% of them were appointed by President Obama. Over 80% of them were confirmed by a Democratic Senate. And they're the ones signing the letter. Even Senator Carper, a Democrat from Delaware, who's the Senate chairman of the Governmental Reform Committee, wrote back to the inspectors general saying these are serious abuses that you have identified and we will hold hearings forthwith. This permeates our government. In the Justice Department, and Hans has written about this today, the Justice Department has withheld essential records from its own inspector general in three different reviews, despite the fact that such records had always been produced for the IG in every other prior review by another administration. In other words, they've changed the rules of the game. In other words, now finally they did get the documents, but only after Attorney General Holder concluded that, well, there was nothing in them that would prove embarrassing. But other documents that could prove embarrassing, like in the Fast and Furious scandal, which took place a couple hundred miles south, a few hundred miles south of here, have still not been produced. The administration is claiming executive privilege, a la Richard Nixon. That's the case which brought Eric Holder the dubious distinction of being the first Attorney General in American history to be censured and held in contempt by the United States House of Representatives. The Fast and Furious documents have still not been released. If you want to ask me when I predict they will be, I think January 2017 is probably a good target date, when of course this administration will be leaving office. Something profoundly embarrassing must be in them. By the way, people always asked us as we were writing this book, what if Eric Holder leaves office? He, after all, is the longest serving cabinet official in the Obama administration. And I would always tell them, don't worry. I can guarantee you that Eric Holder will remain in office until January 20th, 2017, when the Obama administration leaves office. And would say, how can you be sure of that? And I said, for two reasons. One, if he leaves office, there would have to be a confirmation battle for his successor. If it were to happen now, it would actually probably take place in a Republican Senate next year. And that is not something the Obama administration wants. A confirmation battle would open several dozen proverbial cans of worms. In addition, should Eric Holder leave office between now and the end of the administration, I'm confident that he would not be happy in his new profession, which I would call permanent witness. He would be the subject of every deposition, subpoena, and interrogatory you can imagine, and of course would not have the Justice Department to hide behind. Why is it important that we care that the Obama administration is so secretive? Well, for one reason, as Patrick Henry reminded us, we are never secure in our liberties should the activities of those who purport to lead us are concealed from us. The beginnings of tyranny lie in secrecy. That is why our founding fathers demanded that our government be as open and accountable as possible. In addition, think about, this is the 40th anniversary of the departure of Richard Nixon and the end of the Watergate affair. Think about if the standards and the ability of this administration to escape accountability had been applied during the Nixon administration. Cheryl Atkinson of CBS News, who has won several awards for her fearless investigative reporting and is no member of the vast right-wing conspiracy, I can assure you, was asked on ABC News last Sunday, yesterday actually, this is the 40th anniversary of Watergate. If it were covered today, what would have happened? And she said, Nixon would have refused to turn over the tapes to Congress, his aides would have refused to testify to Congress, or they would have taken the Fifth Amendment, as Lois Lerner of the IRS and others have, or they would lie to Congress with a fair amount of impunity. Woodward and Bernstein would be controversialized on social media, pummeled in the blogs by special and political interests who use Facebook accounts. And in the end, the comedy shows would have segments attacking the investigators as being overzealous Inspector Javert's. And finally, the President of the United States would finally appear in one of those shows, make light of the whole affair and say, can't you just get a life? It's time to move on. I don't quite know if she's completely accurate. I'd like to think she wouldn't be. And I'm not automatically drawing a comparison between Watergate and what is happening today. But if you read our book, the violations of the rule of law may not be as severe, but they certainly are plentiful. And frankly, we don't know what we don't know. Because, as not only the media, but the inspectors general have reported, at every step of the way, evasion, denial, confiscation, and delay. And as a result, even the news media is slowly waking up. The former editor of the New York Times, Jill Abramson, has said the Obama administration has a war on the American media in terms of withholding information and evidence, and not just on national security grounds. The Associated Press took a review of all of the FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act requests that have been filed under the Obama administration, and concluded as following. The Obama administration, more than any other previous administration, has censored government files or outright denied access to them under the FOIA Act. Worse than Nixon, worse than Lyndon Johnson, under which FOIA was first passed, worse than any of the Bushes, worse than Clinton. And yet, so many people in this country allow people in the Obama administration to continue to say, this is the most open and transparent administration in history. The danger to our liberties has always been when we allow something that is patently untrue to be largely accepted or unchallenged. Today, we have arrived at the point where Obama is now Orwell. What he says and what actually happens are completely different. Just contrast what was said to the African leaders at the summit last week with what the next day, the very next day, two-thirds of his own inspectors general wrote to Congress to complain about. Thank you.